session number 10420, rule 26.
Colonel W.I. Watson, Reel 26. You wish to go back a little while, Colonel Watson?
Yes, that's so. I'd rather like to go back to our last day's journey between Deltar and Kirkuk, just for a moment. It was a journey of 100 miles. We left Deltar on the 19th of November, and it was a journey which caused a very great strain on all our drivers. The road to start with was nothing but a rough track with a series of bends, one after another, climbing through the large tooth-like faults of that part of the country. There were jagged faults sticking up into the air just like teeth. And all the time, a fearful sandstorm blew, one of the worst, in fact, that I ever experienced. It was accompanied by a following wind and therefore blew all the sand back onto your vehicle. And it got into one's throat, one's eyes, one's nose. And at times it was impossible to see the vehicle in front. And, of course, the resulting pace was incredibly slow. By the time we got to nearer to where we had to pitch our camp, it was pitch dark, and you couldn't see a thing. And as so often happens after a sandstorm, the rain follows. And, of course, on this occasion, it poured down, and the last 7 miles on the oil-bound road was frightful. Not only were the vehicles slipping all over the place on the wet surface, which was just like glass or ice, but if you yourself got out and started to walk on it, you'd fall down and slither about. None of us could barely stand up. There was no proper camp. As I say, it was pitch dark, and we were all completely exhausted. So we made just small leaguers round our vehicles, and hard tack and tea. Tea was made by the company cooks, and hard tack was issued to every man, and then everybody turned into bed as best he could. I had a splitting headache. As a matter of fact, In sandstorms of that nature, it has a nasty effect on you. You feel very down, and all you want to do is to go to sleep. And that was what happened to me on this particular day. But I was able to see everybody into bed. The CO and the brigadier came round, and everybody went to sleep. We did, in fact, lose 1 3-tonner. Which was completely lost, and had to be abandoned. It was a very chilly night. We were still wearing a khaki drill. Now, the next day, it was a chilly day, and the rain started to continued off and on through most of the day. We could see our surroundings. The whole countryside was as flat as a pancake, but in the distance there were some foothills with the famous oil wells and oil plants of Kirkuk. And each platoon was issued with two tents, and they spent the day scrubbing and cleaning and getting clean, cleaning their uniform, which was ingrained with sand. And we went across to the King's Own, who weren't far away, living in comparative luxury. They were, in fact, in barracks, I think, or in a hutted camp of some sort. And I was able to get baths for all my company. They all got washed and the King's Own were reorganizing after some very nasty actions all over the Iraq and the countryside because of Rashid Ali's rebellion. They had been, in fact, right away down by Habaniya, the other side of Baghdad at Fallujah, and there had a nasty battle with the insurgents, and had suffered a certain amount of casualties. But their second in command was a chap called Walton. He was a green hired, and he came from the Thalaton area. I'm not sure his father hadn't been Vicar of Bowes, but a very, very nice chap, and he was the second in command. And he had two aunts that I knew quite well in those days who lived at Cotherston, only 3 miles away from here. He was a good friend to us while we were staying at Kirkuk. On the 23rd of November, this is one of the days that I want to recall, the CO and I, and a chap called Robbins out of the King's Own, who had provided us with the 12-bore shotguns, set off at 8:30, and we went out for a completely change. We went out shooting black partridge. We weren't very good shots. I hit one but couldn't find it. But it was such a wonderful change after all these days we'd had to forget about soldiering and go back to the good old country life in England. And we searched the scrub on the banks of the Little Zab River, and we searched in the nullahs on the Alston Kapoor Road. And there was an old Kurd with a wonderful sense of humor came and gave us a hand, quite voluntary, was very useful. And we searched all the wild country there the whole day. There was one of the Kurd's friends who joined us who could speak Hindustani. And the result of the day was we got 8 black partridges, I see from my records, 1 snipe and 1 quail. And it was quite one of the most enjoyable days I ever spent during the war. Not only that, there were a lot of other interesting birds to see. I think I'm right in saying it was Field Marshal Alan Brooke said if it hadn't been for his love of studying the birds, he'd have gone mental. But when anything went wrong, he just walked out into the country with his field glasses and studied the birds. And that really it happened to me too, off and on throughout the war. Well, as a complete contrast, this is another incident that I want to mention. As a complete contrast, the next day, which would be around about the 24th of November, the CO said he would have a route march for the whole battalion. Mind you, we were in khaki drill, and he said, you will wear battle dress, and you will wear your gas masks at the ready on your chest, and we will have a route march for some 15 miles only. And I just made it, only just. I mean, I don't suppose many people have ever thought of having a route march in battle dress after they've worn khaki drill for months on end. But nevertheless, that was the march. And I don't think I've ever felt so tired afterwards for a very, very long time indeed. And the CO's feet went after the first 7 miles. And the next day, everybody was recovering. And the CO was unable to walk. And I had a nasty blister on my foot, but I was able to walk. But the CO himself was completely out. Now, one of the people that did the march was our new padre. He was a man called Davis, and he was aged 38, and he was an Oxford Rugger Blue, and he, before the war, was a padre, territorial padre with the South Wales Borderers, and subsequently with us in the desert, got a military cross, and he went the whole way around. Our old padre, which we'd taken out from England, poor Bostock, who is now passed on, he was a bit of a nuisance when we arrived in Palestine after Cyprus. He promptly wanted to go to up to Jerusalem and Nazareth without thinking of his battalion. And so he was removed and became a padre at the hospital in Jerusalem. Now, to go back to where we were, you've got to remember, we had no maps. We hadn't a map of the countryside at all. And we had maps, which I've still got, little tracings of the route from Palestine to Baghdad and from Baghdad northwards. Little simple maps that any school boy could have prepared, and they were prepared by the movement control and by the Corps of Military Police. And it was here at Kirkuk that we actually got maps of northern Iraq. And we were also issued with diagrams, which I've got, still got, of the Russian badges of rank, the Iraqi badges of rank, and the English badges of rank. We were issued with those for the first time at Iraq. Now, another thing which I think we were issued then, anyhow, about that time, while we were at Kirkuk, we were issued with sun compasses. Now, if you can't use a compass, as you probably know, in a car or a truck, you've got to get well away from it, and then you can use your compass. But if you have a sun compass, you put it on your bonnet, and while you were driving the car, you could read your sun compass, which was really like a compass with a needle sticking up. And these were issued for while we were up there. And I remember taking out my company on this very flat area, flat for miles round, to a little hill, a little mound that rose out of the ground called Zara Tepe. And there were thousands and thousands and thousands of these grand sand grouse. And I had a Sergeant Housen then, who came from Barnacastle, who was one of my Teesdale regulars. And I can remember him saying, by Jove, wouldn't it be wonderful if we had all these sand grouse on Bowes Moor? Incidentally, sand grouse aren't grouse, they're a form of pigeon. But there were thousands of them, all migrating southwards from the steppes of Russia to the warmer climates of Africa. However, this was the beginning of December. And I think on the last day of November, it was a bitterly cold night with a very clear moon. And next morning, there was a thick covering ice on all our wash basins. And this, indeed, was the warning of things to come. And I know that in the first day or two in December, Tim Chamberlain, my number two, bought a thermometer, and it registered 44 in the daytime and 40 at 7:50 p.m. that night. That day, incidentally, we'd gone out field firing, and the company had gone out field firing, and there were two mounted police, Iraqi police. Most of the police in Iraq in that part of the country were mounted, and they came and watched us for some time and made friends with the chaps who were firing. Well, then on the 4th of December, or perhaps it was that day, the 3rd of December, the CO had a conference of our on our move to Eskekelet. And this is what I'd forgotten. The battalion headquarters, B Company, that's my company, and D Company, and headquarter company, and the transport, all went by road. But A and C Company, and the 8th and 9th DLI, had to do the whole of the 85 miles by march. And they were to do it in daily stretches of about 15 to 16 miles. The orders were that we would go up there to Eskekelet and dig these positions overlooking the Great Dam River on the lines of communication. It was the lines of communication to prevent the Germans breaking through into Persia and North Iraq, and then return. And had that been so, there's undoubtedly that battalion headquarters and B and D Company would have all had to march back. But this time they were going to do it in luxury by being conveyed in transport. And then on the 4th of December, it was bitterly cold and a day, and I went with David Rome, one of my platoon commanders, into Kirkuk. And it was Kirkuk was a garrison town. There was a cavalry unit there, horse cavalry unit of the Iraqi army, as well as infantry. And the whole place was seething of soldiery, Iraqi soldiery. We'd been warned to be on our guard for any trouble by the King's Own, but we never experienced any. And I remember going round the bazaar there, just like any other bazaar you see in the Middle East. There were boiled sheep's heads and dried tongues and goldsmiths and silversmiths and cobblers and joiners and all the rest working in their shops, open-fronted shops. We didn't stay there very long. It was just a typical, rather dirty Iraqi town. It had a good, I think I remember rightly, it had a good sort of citadel on the top, castle or barracks, it was interesting from that point of view. The next day, the 5th of December, after a terribly cold night, which was just above freezing in our tent, we embussed at 8:45, and we were off at 9, through the Karni Domlam, these jagged teeth, to Alton Kapru, and I've already described Erbil, we were seen through Erbil by the mounted police, and we were all still in a non-tribal area, but north of us, just north of us, the tribes came into existence. They were tribal area. They were just north of us when we got to Eskekelet. They were all tribes. But all along the way, we saw the high hills in the distance with deep snow and Yonin or Yunin, or I think was our interpreter, said, "Oh yes, you wait. Let's wait till we get to the other end." They were appreciably high mountains on the Persian border. One thing we noticed, and we noticed continually while we were there, were the shepherds and the camel herds, camelmen, wearing their coats of felt, and they had the arms of these coats sticking out at right angles, but they never put their arms in it. They just wrapped the coats around themselves. And also, when we did get to the fearful snowy weather for the first 10 days in January, they wore these coats and I suppose slept in them, and they only had sandals on their feet the whole time. They never changed to anything else other than sandals, even in the deep snow. And they must have suffered terribly. And incidentally, looking back on it, the inhabitants of the whole of the area in that part of the world must have suffered too, because they didn't have any heating in their houses and they didn't have glass in their windows or anything like that. Anyhow, we got to Eskikelik and we arrived there, and the next day we dug ourselves in for an hour before it poured with rain. Sheets of rain came down, and we all got, I went round the with the seal around the position at which we were to dig, above Eskikelik, and it was became an absolute quagmire, and of course everything had to stop. I think I've described our positions. They were on the high ground, appreciably high ground, overlooking the little tiny police post and veterinary post on the banks of the Great Zab River, the bridge of which, over which, had been partially destroyed by Rashid Ali's rebellion. Now, the 8th Battalion, which I don't think I have mentioned, were to guard the approaches to the bridge. We were on the other side of they were on the east side of the river. We were on the west side, overlooking right down below the bridge itself and the river, and the 9th Battalion were guarding the approaches to Mosul. I think I said Mosul was about 40 miles away, but it wasn't. It was nearer 20. And about the 8th of December, there was a sharp frost, but it was a glorious day, and we started on our task. Now the other two companies were beginning to arrive on their flat feet. And out of the two companies, A and C Company, under command of Major Ferens, none had fallen out. But the 9th DLI, on the very first day, they had 190. Admittedly, I don't think they'd taken so much exercise that we had done, but the brigade commander was very concerned that such a large number should have fallen out. And I remember on the same day as I heard that news, a whole lot of vultures flew over the my part of my area, for a digging area. And I thought, heavens, what are they looking for? What are they looking for? I was still very anxious to get a gun. And round about the middle of the beginning of December, sometime in the beginning of December, I think it was about the 9th or something like that, I went to Mosul. And for the first, my first visit to Mosul with the interpreter. And incidentally, this interpreter was an Assyrian and a Christian. And we had a force, an irregular force, in Habaniya and elsewhere on the aerodromes of Iraqi levies. And he had been an Iraqi levy, and he did in fact combine, I think, interpreting, acting as interpreter for us, as well as trying to get recruits for the Iraqi levies. Now, long after the war was over, Captain Vaux, who'd been our adjutant before the war, left the DLI after the war and went to the Royal Air Force Regiment, and he was in command of all the Iraqi levies. That's what he did, was in command of. And his aeroplane crashed, flying from one aerodrome in a sandstorm, and it went into the Tigris, and that was the end of him. But he commanded the Iraqi levies subsequently. And they wore a slouch cap with a little white tuft of vulture feathers. And they were very smart and a very pleasant set of people to work with. Anyhow, that's rather a sideline. But our interpreter had been an Iraqi levy, and I think he was also trying to get recruits. Anyhow, I went to Mosul with him, as he thought his brother, who I think kept an hotel in Mosul, would be able to help us. And we went through Nineveh, which is the ancient town of Nineveh, and all that is now left were vast embankments, which would be about 2 miles long and about a mile wide, just before you came to the bridge to cross the Tigris and into Mosul. But you were completely held up getting across the bridge by hundreds and hundreds of flocks of sheep and camels, camel trains coming from all over. And it took you about a quarter of an hour to get across the bridge because of these animals. And I remember there was one very tired sheep which I saw the shepherd just lift up, put on a donkey, and we carried it across the bridge. And it seemed perfectly all right when it got to the other side. I suppose they were all just going into Mosul before proceeding on into Syria and elsewhere down in Palestine. And of course, there were empty camel trains coming back.